IDD operation, operation Pisa Bay. All right, we do have an alternative from the EFF. Thank you very much, Honourable Matiaki. Thank you so much. Right, okay. And we will immediately shift over to yourself then. Who's going to make the presentation? Both of you. Just indicate who's speaking. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. My name is Bonnie Mehlomakulu. I'm the CEO of the South African Bureau of Standards. I'll be sharing this presentation with Ms. Musako, who's the CFO. Greetings to the Honourable Members, the Department of Trade and Industry, Director General and the DDG, the Chief Director responsible for the SQAM entities, Dr. Demane. We thank them for their continued support and guidance over the years. Honourable Chairperson, we are, as a team, going to take you through the performance of the organization over the last year, focusing on quarter four performance, which rounds off the year. We've decided to use a South African flag as this year SABS celebrates 70 years of existence. And when South Africa was transitioning to democracy, we were involved as the South African Bureau of Standards in the development of the flag, the dimensions of that you see in the flag, and how the flag should be hosted. That all came from the work that the South African Bureau of Standards does. So as we celebrate 70 years of our existence, we wanted to highlight the contributions that we've made to the economy as well. Just a quick outline of the presentation. We will do the operational highlights and take the committee through the performance against predetermined objectives and our financial performance as an organization. About 5 years ago, 6 years ago, the SABS went through a big transition in the legislation. After 65 years of the SABS being everything quality assurance, which meant that the regulatory function, the accreditation, and everything that has to do with standardization at one point was under the wing of the SABS, and over the years, that was taken to different entities as the international recommendations of dealing with competition and trade issues was embraced in the country. A number of legislations had to be passed to take certain functions of the SABS out of the SABS. The latest one was the removal of the regulatory function from the SABS in 2008. And the establishment of the regulatory function. We today still, you know, going through the change management process as the economy still thinks that the SABS is a regulatory, and as a result, when our customers or our stakeholders engage with the functions of the SABS, there's always an expectation that the SABS will regulate the economy. And what we do is supporting regulations through services that we give to the regulator. And that's an important definition of our objective or our function for us, because what then happens is that when we engage with stakeholders, if that's not explained upfront, we then find ourselves having to deal with issues of regulatory that have now been assigned to the NRCS. We are grateful though for the foundation that we are using today as the SABS to continue to exist and give services to the economy. if it wasn't for that foundation, we would not be giving employment to about 1,100 people in this country. In various technical areas, in standards development, in laboratories and certification, in training and in the design institute, and offices and laboratories spread throughout the country. This is the foundation that came with the SABS being part of the regulator, but we now leveraging this infrastructure in order to add value to the economy. And we're hoping that we are able to leverage this technical infrastructure that we've inherited as an organization to continue to impact the country positively. We have a large facility in Groenteloop, and some of the committee members have been able to see the physical infrastructure. At the moment, it's not optimally used. We are occupying about 25% of the land, and there are plans to reuse the land more profitably, so that we are able to accommodate other functions within the SABS campus. The campus is wholly owned by the SABS, and we're working with the DTI to find mechanisms to leverage more value for the economy out of the campus. In our services, we have footprints outside of South Africa. We service customers in Europe, in the Americas, Australia, Asia, and the rest of the continent. The footprint of the SABS really says that if we wanted as an economy to engage strategically with the other parts of the world, we mustn't leave the SABS behind in the engagement that we're having with other economies on issues of trade. And we see, you know, a lot of cases where our government struggles with engagement that have to do with quality of goods, and we are not quite involved in those engagements, and we would like to assist in areas like those. The value chain of activities at the SABS, and I draw a faint blue line to separate the functions that we perform out of the legislated mandate and the functions that the mandate gave us options to get into for the country. But we need to keep a Chinese wall between the work we're doing for the country in standards and the conformity assessment work that we do commercially, so that there isn't a conflict of interest. SABS is funded about 25% through the government grant and 75% through the income that we get leveraging the infrastructure that government has put in place for us. We've added the Design Institute activities, and at the moment those activities are subsidized through the grant, but you know, as we develop the activities, we would like to see the activities being taken up as value-added activities by state entities and companies that want to develop SMEs. The value chain of the SABS activities positions the entity very well to give holistic quality assurance solutions to government departments, to state entities, and to private sector companies. We found over the years that whilst we service the private sector very well, we have not been able to provide the same services to the public sector, and it's been a strategic objective of ours to really start to engage our stakeholders differently and talk about value add in state entities. The role we play in the international platforms, we see that as an important role. There are politics of developing and developed countries, emerging economies versus the West when it comes to issues of standards. Some standards come already in draft from certain parts of the world, and when they come to ISO or IEC platform, as developing countries, we engage with them from a platform of just commenting on the content that's already there. So strategically, from 5 years ago, we decided as the SABS that we wanted to influence some of those agendas so that we can get the issues of standards development for our country and for our region to be heard. So I serve on the ASIO Council on behalf of South Africa, and we in that platform govern the issues of standards internationally. Dr. Fadwil Bison, who's our head of standards, serves on the IEC Council that works on electronic and electrical standards. We also a secretariat for SADC 10, and FABS hosts that office. Fadwil also serves on the ISO CMB, that's the technical management board of ISO. Katima Temba, the executive for testing, serves on the ASO, that's the African Standards Coalition Body, and he serves on that council to influence that agenda. And recently, for the first time in the history of ISO and international standards engagement, the ISO Council appointed a new chair of CASCO, that's the Conformity Assessment Body of ISO. And it's for the first time that chair has come from Africa, and SABS got that nomination and was voted by all members, and Mr. Frank Makamo, our executive for certification, will be assuming that responsibility from 2016. And really, for us, we're hoping to use these positions to influence certain agendas for the country. It's often very difficult. It's a committee of ISO that's responsible for conformity assessment, and it's for the first time that it's got a chair from Africa, and SABS got that nomination and was voted in as the chair starting 2016. The emphasis, Honourable Chair, that I was making on that is this presents an opportunity for South Africa to start influencing certain decisions about the movement of goods, and how we as the different trading zones start to engage with how goods get accepted, and how certain parts of the world use standards and technical barriers to trade stop certain transactions from happening. And we're hoping to influence those agendas and really challenge certain rules that have been embedded in those structures using the positions that we have. And the engagement with the portfolio committee, with our portfolio committee and our shareholder, will assist us to enrich that agenda so that we can create value for the country in these engagements. We're now going to move to the matter of operational indicators, and from my side, before I hand over to the CFO, I haven't been with the SABS for 5 years. This is my sixth year with the SABS, and worked with the board, with the DTI, with the employees of the organization. I'm proud to say that we've been able to get a clean audit for 3 years now, and we one of the entities of the DTI that got the first clean audit award 3 years ago from the Auditor General. It presents a platform for us where we can then start to make improvements internally in terms of our operations and the services that we give in the economy, because corporate governance issues are in place, and we are taking care of controls within the organization that allow us to get the clean audit. I would now like to introduce the CFO, Ms. Mosako, to take you through the issues of operational indicators.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and greetings to Honourable Members, the DG of the DTI, and the respective Chief Directorate. I don't know if you can hear me from. Can you hear me? Okay, just try this one. Okay, let me just try this one. Okay. Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and to the Honourable Members, and to the DG of the DTI. Just at a high level, you know, standards continue to play a catalytic role in, you know, driving the economy of this country. From an SABS perspective, you know, despite the fact that we've had tough economic times over the past 2 years, we've had growth in revenue of 8% compared to 6%, and we've had expenditure increasing by 5% compared to 10% in the previous year. What does this mean, you know, when you look at the overall economic environment? Our inflation is currently sitting at just over 5%, and we've actually, you know, managed to grow our revenue base above the inflation rate. However, on the cost side, even though we've managed to contain our costs, and it is inherent in the organization to maintain our costs, our employee benefits have actually, you know, increased by double inflation rate. And this is mainly driven by the union, you know, negotiations, where, you know, we have to look at increasing the lower level employee salaries. We continue to support growth through our SMMEs. I don't know if I've got the, I just go through the next slide, okay. Through SMMEs with our Design Institute. There's a lot to say on the Design Institute and the achievement that we have made so far, where we actually supporting young entrepreneurs in developing their products and in also commercializing their products. This is an initiative that we're doing together with TIA. You know, TIA is one of our supporters in this project. What is key to highlight there is you know, most big economies are driven by entrepreneurship and great ideas. You see your Silicon Valleys. So we are actually hoping that, you know, the Design Institute, you know, is moving in the direction of creating the Silicon Valleys for the country. On the publishing of homegrown standards, if you can see, we had planned to, we had a target of about 225. We actually managed to achieve 232, which is, you know, much higher than what we expected, which is good progress on our side. Okay, I mean, just in summary, you know, as we continue to strive for excellence as an organization, in terms of our predetermined objectives, we achieved 81%. So it's the 13 out of 16. Though 81% is an A, we do, you know, strive that we will continue to do better going forward. What has contributed to this? I've already highlighted on the revenue side that though we did manage to grow our revenue, we didn't manage to achieve our targets. However, we did manage to achieve our bottom line profits. On the new certification schemes, we managed to create two schemes. We created courses, three new courses, because one of the key initiatives is to provide training to organizations on standards, and we managed to provide new courses. I've already mentioned the issues around the homegrown standards. What you find is, you know, on the things that affect the economy and what our key mandate is, we have actually, you know, met our objectives. You know, where we didn't meet our objectives is more around our internal operational issues. When you look at our project, LIMS project, which is an IT system, we had managed to, we're expecting to roll out to all our labs. We only managed to do 86% of that, but we're expecting to be completed in the 2015-2016 year. Okay, the reduced time for publication of standards, we've managed to, you know, land up at, you know, the target was less than 400 hours, so we landed up with 398, you know, and we will take any improvement in efficiency as much as possible, so we see that coming through as well. Our modernization of laboratory activities, because we find that some of our labs have had old equipment, and now we're going, you know, through the modernization process to be able to derive key, you know, efficiencies that come from that, and we've managed to meet our targets there. And the developed improvement in customer and stakeholder relations, that has been an improvement. Development of SMMEs, I've already highlighted all the work that we're doing in that space. I mean, we've actually managed to develop more than double what we expected to do. And the more we do in this space, then it means just the more we develop, the greater probability of, you know, more successful organizations coming out of this. Okay. Then we've had EU committees, we've exceeded our target by about 3%. We've had, one of the key things that we drive as an organization is that we recognize and we do know that our greatest advantage as an organization is our people. And it is very critical that we continue to develop our people, and we also create a pipeline for succession planning. One of the things that we have endured on is our graduate and student internship program, and this not only, you know, satisfies the needs of the organization, but also addresses a national imperative of youth employment. We've had leadership development programs that we've also run. This also speaks to our people development strategy. And then in terms of our workforce capacity, we've actually managed to keep our vacancy rate below 3.4%. Okay. I mean, on the financial performance side, I've managed to highlight already how we've done on the revenue side, and also on how the employee benefits increased by 12%, which is double inflation. We've had our assets increasing by 44%, and we continue, you know, to invest in CapEx, which mainly goes towards the modernization of our laboratories. Okay. Now, on the income statement side, I've already, you know, highlighted all the issues around the revenue, the costs as well. Now, what is critical in any organization is to build a balance sheet that is, you know, that will, you know, as I would say, like a good castle, stand the test of time. In a sense that, you know, creating, you know, resiliency. You know, it's creating, you know, a resilient balance sheet that can be able to provide buffers during economic times. We've actually managed to grow our balance sheet substantially over the past 7 years, where we've actually seen our balance sheet double from, you know, for the past 7 years. And as the CEO has already highlighted, with us seeking to derive more of the property portfolio that we currently have, we will see this pattern continuing. Now, what are the challenges? You know, we've heard you know, the greater achievement and briefly what some of the issues are, but mainly driven by the economy. We've had a cut in our grant from the DTI, so that's one of the challenges that we currently have as an organization, and also the slow growth in revenue. So the challenge to us as an organization is to strategize and be innovative in, you know, finding ways to actually, you know, create the revenue opportunities to be able to remain financially sustainable as an organization. I will now pass on to the CEO. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And as we engage with the issue of, constrained fiscus, we want to leverage the capacity that we have as an organization to make sure that we can keep all of our employees employed and gainfully, you know, employed. I think the biggest failure as a leader of the organization will be to tell people that they have to you know, to go home because we can't afford them. So by every means possible, as a team, we are going to be, you know, putting our services out there to make sure that we can have enough revenue to keep our employees in their jobs. In the original presentation, the type on that slide, but what the last slide is really trying to say is whether we are, as the SABS, with the capacity we have and the infrastructure that's in place, are we optimally used in this economy? We get approached when people just want a test report. There is a tender, you know, entrepreneurs come running to the SABS and the tender is closing and they want a test report. They go to the extent of calling 702 when they can't get a test report. They are not engaging with the issue of quality assurance and standardization as a value add to their business. They just want a test report so that they can get a tender. And we would like to get past that. We want to be able to get to a space where we are partners and we add value, because that's what we are about. We want to leverage the capacity we have to add value. And the economy that just wants a test, a report, so that they can get a tender in a state entity is something that is becoming a challenge for the SABS. We've seen a lot of challenges that come back to defraying this government challenges, but they have to do with issues of quality assurance that maybe are not well understood in the economy or the entities that are procuring. The examples that we've seen, the current example has to do with the wrong or allegedly wrong size of chain, height of chains procured by Qatar. In an economy that has such a large national standard body, something like that should not happen. We are there as a resource that the economy should be using to make sure that the issues of standardization are managed properly, holistically, in a coordinated manner, so that when we spend money as an economy, we spend money on the properly spec'd goods that we need for the economy. And that's an area that I think going forward we'll be focusing on in order for us to be able to educate our stakeholders about what value can they get from the various activities that we have as the SABS. the Design Institute, the numbers are low for me, given the challenges we have of unemployment in this country and youth unemployment. The numbers of young entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs or SMEs that we're touching at the moment is low. We would like to grow that. We've brought a big black bookie there for the committee members in order for them to be able to see the young entrepreneurs that have gone through our Design Institute. We would like to have this activity in every region where SABS has an office. Where we don't have an office, we want to collaborate with other DCI entities like where they have regional offices or small business enterprise offices in CEDA and engage with entrepreneurs and young entrepreneurs in those regions. But this is the work that the DTI has done in contributing to the economy, and we would like for the committee to really, you know, support the work of the Design Institute. It's an entity that was put in place to support the manufacturing sector. Over 40 years, it's probably, you know, lost focus. We've refocused it, and we've given it a mandate, and it's touching lives in a significant way, and we would like to see more lives being impacted through the work of the Design Institute. Honorable Chair and members, that's our story for today. We're back next week, I think, for more work on the Design Institute. We will be exhibiting some of the work that the young entrepreneurs have done. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, CEO. I must say we always have found this entity very exciting, and well, I know members have got a number of comments and questions. Thank you very much. Over to members quickly. Honourable Williams, Honourable Mkongi, Honourable Albert, Honourable Kornhoff, yes, Honourable McPherson, thank you. And seeing as there are five of you, let's try and look at 2 minutes or so.
Thanks, Chairperson. I've just got a couple of questions. Firstly, the Auditor General talked to challenges around your IT governance and IT systems control, and I just want to know what you're going to do about those challenges. And secondly, on the slide, unfortunately it doesn't have page numbers, it's the baseline cut slide. It indicates that your expenditure is far greater than your income, and that situation is unsustainable, and I'd just like to know what are you doing to curb that trend, because in the long term, especially, well, it's never sustainable. So I just want to know what you're going to do to curb your over-expenditure. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Honourable Mkongi.
Yeah, no, thank you very much, Mr. President. I think I just want to welcome the presentation. You know, this weekend on Sunday, I was assisting my friend to understand the elasticity of demand and supply. And when I was explaining this, he could not understand the economic language. And I had to explain it using cigarette. You know, when you buy your cigarette and what you, and then you could understand complementary and substitute goods. Now, yeah, even financial language is having that problem. Your slide doesn't have a number where you spoke about operational indicators. It says that your annual growth in revenue increased by 8% compared to only 6% in the previous year. Your report tells you that your profits and the sales, yes, you said your sales revenue and operating profits decreased, and that exerted dampening effect. I wanted to know, I already written about it, that explained those dampening effects, but now I'm finding at the end in financials that you are saying that you increase. May you explain to me that is the first one. The second one I was going to ask you about this design institute, because I was going to ask you, where are these people? You want to see them? How many are they? What are they doing now? You know, you say you are coming next week. Maybe we can explain further next week, but you can also explain today. But this year, I'm very concerned. When we went to our oversight visit to the entities, most of the entities were complaining about exorbitant fees they pay for rents where they are renting their own buildings. But I'm getting a report here that staff says land, and the land is not used optimally. And what are the plans for using that land optimally? Making it a one-stop center for entities of the city that are paying high fees somewhere, you know, into one where people is going to this, staff is going to another entity of the city and so forth. I have, if Chairperson, at the end, you can give us some other route. There are many questions of importance that they need to answer. The laboratory question, what is happening there? You know, information management system, the target was not achieved. What is the problem? What is the plan to complete that? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mkongi, Honorable Elvis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to know the Design Institute's program, what benefits does it give the SME beneficiaries exactly? Can you just give us an explanation on that? Also, the published homegrown standards, there were quite a lot actually achieved, 232. Can you just give us an idea on the types of standards that were designed or accepted by yourselves? And then lastly, the reduced time for publication of standards. It seems it takes a little bit more than a year to accept and publish a standard. Can you tell me how you help your applicants in the meantime, while a standard is being approved, to try and access markets, if there's any system in place to try and allow for that? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Cornwall.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to add, I'm also concerned about that baseline slide for the over expenditure, so it is a concern. Then if you look at your income statement, I just want an explanation why rental income was, you know, doing so good, and you know, what was the reason for that? Is it 60, do I understand it correctly, it's 62% up to the prior year and the actual income. So if you can explain that. And then there were rumors that the Design Institute is going to be cut. So if I hear you correctly, that you are bragging about the Design Institute, I'm glad to hear that, because I think it is the good news story of SABS. So just a little bit more. What's, you know, are you really trying to build it out? Or is there a concern because of the baseline cut by the department that you will take money away from the Design Institute?
Thank you. Honorable McPherson.
Thank you, Chair. So just a comment and a question. You know, I think that someone said in the media not so long ago that, in fact, it was actually an opinion piece by the former parliamentary leader for the DA, Tony Leon, who said that, you know, every department and everything that we do should be like a laser beam on job creation. And with respect to the SABS, and they have a very important role to do, because, I mean, we don't want faulty products within the consumer market. But sometimes I feel that the... that those that are, you know, involved in the testing and certification of products, you know, take their time to, you know, respond to customers, because at the end of the day, you know, they are your customers, because they do pay you for that privilege to have their product certified. I mean, and just yesterday, or was it Friday, I got an email from a gentleman at the SABS who said, you respond to when I get back. And I just felt that that was a totally inappropriate response to a person who has hit a brick wall in trying to get a product certified that is going to create jobs and going to generate revenue. And so my question to you is what measures are you putting in place to ensure that the SAVS is not a hindrance to driving economic growth, but in fact is an accessory to that? And are those sorts of comments acceptable in your eyes? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable McPherson. I have just one related question on the remote laboratories. In fact, it was indicated that when it came to your targets, etc., that you had not been able to get that particular target on the remote laboratories, all right? And yet, further on, you made a reference to these remote laboratories indicating that money had been allocated to them. Perhaps that anomaly could best be explained by yourselves. And I think it's quite important that we get a clarification on the property per se, the land. Thank you. Over to yourself. You've got 10 minutes.
The Honourable Chair and Honourable Members for their questions. IT governance, the issue of IT governance and controls. I spoke about the long history that SABS has had, and that for 65 years of the 70 years, SABS was a regulator, and as a regulator with the powers over extending powers, the focus on modernizing the infrastructure was probably not a priority. We, 3 years ago, with the board, then decided that we were going to invest in our IT infrastructure so that our labs can run on IT platforms, our certification should run on IT platforms, our standards development should run on IT platforms, and that's the project that we are monitoring in different indicators. You see e-committees, you see LIMS, it's specific for the LIMS, but there's a whole IT migration program that is underway at the moment at the SABS. And so you would find that in different areas there will be controls that need improvement as we go through these changes. So the auditors will pick up on those controls, and they have the controls that have to do with the interoperability of certain functions, the CRM working on with the customer data well with our JDE, which does the billing. So there are a number of IT issues that have to do with the systems working together and being able to control the information that we're dealing with. But there is a major focus currently on modernizing our business. Expenditure and income, and I never want, when you have an understanding of really the challenges that the country and the economy has in terms of the fiscus, the constraints on the fiscus, and I don't want to come and complain that the budget has been cut, you know, as if it's something that was done to the SABS and SABS alone. I think it's just general with most of the entities. I've chosen with my effort to say we have an infrastructure in place that we can use to leverage growth, and obviously the number of dependencies there, we can't force people to use the SABS services. They pay for those services. We have to be customer centric, and I'm going to come to the response to the customer that came through. So we're leveraging the resources we have and the opportunities that we're given by our government to make revenue so that we don't exert
undue pressure on the fiscal that is already constrained by, you know, by other means. But the cut has a real impact that you see in the numbers. So when we were planning over 3 years, we had not planned for the cut, so the expenditure was going to be aligned. So as the cut happens, then the numbers start to change. And so we have a bigger target now to grow our revenue to cover for that, because we understand that the whole economy has a fiscal a crunch with the economic growth being depressed at the moment. And then the issue of LIMS, as I say, it's a project that's under development. We stretch ourselves and we target to implement it quickly, and there are realities of all the equipment in some of the remote laboratories, and to integrate all the equipment into an IT platform is sometimes difficult. And in line with the Honorable Chair's question, so when you start to implement an IT platform on an old equipment, you then find it easier to procure new equipment in order for you to be able to get the platform to work. So when you get to the implementation, you find real equipment problems, and you have to stop and go procure new equipment in order for you to be able to implement it. So those are linked, the expenditure on the equipment and the delays on LIMS. It has to do with the equipment that was not able to link up to the process. The impact on the SMEs, I really do want to for the students and the beneficiaries themselves to tell their story, and you know, to say where they've gotten to. Some of them have been able to put their product. One of the beneficiaries in the book was able to get a grant from Itala Bank, and they're producing now their milk, and you can find the milk at Woolworths. One of them is the product has been taken up by Unilever, and some of them have won many awards, and some of them are engaging with procurement supply chain of various state entities, and we take them through that process. The SABS infrastructure gives the right technical base for a new product to be passed through the quality assurance and to get the right credibility in the market to then link onto other business support mechanisms that are already existing in the country. That's why we think the Design Institute is best positioned within the SABS because of the technical know-how that exists to support an entrepreneur that's bringing a technical project to the SABS. Homegrown standards are developed to support uniquely South African programs. An example will be traditional medicine. Chinese traditional medicines exist alongside modern medicine in Chinese hospitals. You get to choose whether you want traditional Chinese treatment or you want Western treatment. And in our economy, in Zoro, they come and beneficiate some of our products to add into pharmaceuticals. We do not engage with that and formalize that as a part of the economy. So that full value chain of traditional medicines and also the health aspect of it. Sometimes you find trace minerals in the formulations, even the measurements. If I'm not educated and I can't read the label that FABS has put in, if I know that if the bottle top is green, that means I can drink it. If it's red, it means I shouldn't drink it. If it's blue, it means it's for washing. And that's a standard. But it's a standard that you then communicate to the users in a different way. So those are some of the homegrown set-top boxes. That whole area is very unique to a geographical area, and it needs to be developed for that area.
because of the different interferences that will exist in a certain geographical area. In South Africa, we have unique conditions, and so we can't develop an international standard and adopt an international standard to use for transmission. So we have to develop homegrown standards. I'll hand over to the CFO to deal with the financial issues. But I'd like to talk to the issue of testing, certification, and job creation, because you know, I find that companies that have not done what's expected of them easily write to parliamentarians and honourable members to say the SABS is not servicing me. And when we engage deeply, you find that the person is asking for the SABS to make a plan. So half the time, it will be SABS employees, you know, sometimes getting tired of telling the person the same thing, and they will say, you know, we're not engaging. At another end, it will be somebody trying to get a quick way through without really engaging with the process. And I'm not denying that there are challenges with service delivery, but the language that is used by people when they have not followed the right process and they will want the SABS to make concessions for them is always job creation. I have a library of complaints sometimes that are talking about job creation, but when you then investigate and I go and I engage with those issues, you find that the company does not meet the standard. And they believe that the SABS should make a plan for them because they are creating, they're supposed to be creating jobs. My message is that those jobs are not sustainable if they are not on the right footing. In order for us to level the playing field, we must make sure that everyone operates with the same quality of standard and the same testing and certification. And there's a commitment from my side in terms of operation is that we are going to maintain that fairness internally within the SABS. So no one should get a back through backdoor access to the certification. If that's happening, then we need to know in order for us to be able to deal with it. But if somebody is going to say the process is long and the process is long for everyone, unless if somebody can show that the other person got it in 2 days, I'm being told to wait 10 days, that I want to engage with because that's unfair. But the people can't use the job creation card in order for them to bypass processes. And that's the balance that I would like for us to have as we engage with complaints about long processes and timelines.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable members, the CEO has already alluded to the question on the baseline. But what I'd like to highlight, which one of the members has raised, is that we had targeted a certain revenue number. Even though we have grown by 8% from the revenue we did in the prior year, we did not meet the target that we had expected to meet. And that's why you find that that section is actually read in the operational, even though we did grow, but we didn't meet what we expected to meet. Yes. So there was growth, but not growth as we had expected. I think that was the only...
being here. You know, what we are going to ask you still to come back in writing with one or two responses. We'd like them fleshed out a bit. Have you finished responding?
Yes.
Thank you. Yes. So deal with the property.
On the property, and you know, sometimes when you become innovative and you know, you say there is more we can do with this, you create a problem for other people. And I want to apologize to my principals at the DTI that it then looks like they haven't done anything about the property. It's it's SABS that is supposed to raise this with the shareholder and say we would like to do something. And we've only just started that engagement with them. We have not given them an opportunity to say, you know, yes or no. You know, it's an innovation from our part that is a recent, you know, innovative engagement. We saw what was done with Linwood Bridge, those who are in Pretoria. We would like to see the same happening here. So it's not therefore that it hasn't been developed. It's an infrastructure that's there. We would like to use it. We would like to get support to develop it, you know, with the mechanisms, but we have not engaged them formally.
Engagement will now take place.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, Chair, and in addition to that, Honourable Chair, that we don't, you know, we are not the only tenants in our own property. We have the CIDB and the NCRS sharing the campus with us currently. And if you see, I think one of the members had the question around the rental income, and that is actually gone up because we're now, you know, seeing the benefits of starting to have the tenants and accommodate others.
Well, what we'll do is we'll get a response from you, and then we'll get a more policy response from the DTI on this matter. But if you would come back in writing to respond to the laboratory issue in writing, because I want to know exactly what the technical problems are. And you mentioned in passing the limbs, just explain that. Just come to grips and explain to us what these technical problems are, how can they be avoided or controlled, and what sort of plan will you have to ensure that such technical problems don't occur in the future. So it's all about the remote laboratories. And then the second issue that we need you to come back in writing is the issue around the property, but we'll also speak to the DTI directly on that. All right. Thank you very much. And we do appreciate you coming here. We are going to have a small issue next week. I've just received correspondence from the Chair of Chairs, the Honourable Froelich. But it won't affect an exhibition. We may be able to hold the meeting for an hour, you know, 8 to 9, and the exhibition continue while Parliament deals with other matters. Because committee meetings won't be allowed to be held on the day that we've scheduled. But at the same time. But I think they start only at 9, is that right, or 9:30? We don't have the program, but I know it won't be 8 o'clock or 8:30. I know that. So, yes, another written response?
To raise something, if they are available, we are hosting a youth summit, African Youth Summit, as far as here in Parliament, discussing the sustainable development goals.
Uh-huh.
So if you are available with young people, you can exhibit also there.
Well, there we are, and I would assume you can have a, just put this in more formal arrangements, Honourable Mkolgi, because they can't just trot down, but I know that with the youth engagement, that will be organised and seen of a really high value, okay? So we'll engage with the Honourable Mkolgi, because that is, again, Parliament. It's not a particular committee, but it'll add great value. Thank you, both of you. Really appreciate it. We need to move very swiftly over to the National Lotteries Commission. This, the commission now, isn't it? Isn't that right? You know, we're really very happy to invite you here, Prof, as well as the commissioner. Mampani, we've got Professor Nebu Thunder, the chairperson of the National Lotteries Commission, and then we've got Ms. Tabani Mampani, the commissioner, Mr. Ledwabo, the CFO, Mr. Dupree, the senior executive grant funding, and Mr. Chilwani. So, really, we're looking forward to hearing how the amendments have come into play, the few changes that have been made. Are you going to stay where you are? You well, because I see that the laptop that for use is over here, so I think you may need to change. Is that right? Yes. This arises from a letter received, well, I received today, but is dated the 14th of August. So the program will undergo a slight change. All right? Thank you. Let's get back to our program agenda of the day. Right. Now, who's going to make the presentation, Professor? Will it be yourself or Commissioner Mampani? Would you like to preface and open the meeting?
Start and thank you. Commissioner will come in and grant funding and as well as CFO. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and members. We have been introduced. Let's go straight to how we are going to present what we are requested to do. The introduction. Non-financial performance, grant funding performance, financial performance, and we will conclude. I must say, Honorable Chair and members, we thank the Department of Trade and Industry for helping us in coming up with the Amendment Act of 2013. Which was signed by the President, and thereafter the Department also helped us speedily to do the regulations which were publicized on the 14th of April 2015. That made us to say to the 1997 Act, bye-bye, and we launched our NLC, National Lotus Commission, on the 29th of June this year. And it was a shift of emphasis in terms of what we are going to do as from now. You all know that as the National Lotus Commission, the mandate is not changed. We are a regulatory body, and we also we become a funder. In this case, most people outside there, they know us as doing grant funding to beneficiaries. But however, we also regulate national lottery and other lotteries as well as sport pools. The new act and regulations have put in place they reorganized the sectors. In terms of the regulations, charities which were given 45% in the new old act have been improved. It is now 47% of the total budget that we give to organizations. Arts, which were 28, has been reduced to 23. Simply because there are other programs that the Department of Trade and Industry do have. For example, you know, those who are in the filling industry and many other things. So the departments do give some incentives for those people who are in that sector. sports has increased from 22 to 28, which means that the sports is now catered with more money. We are going to build so many things on the ground, and we are going to assist even school sports. Miscellaneous, which was 5%, it has been reduced to 2%, simply because miscellaneous was the competency of the board. Now the new act has put emphasis that the board should not be an adjudicator. The board should review the work that is done by the distributing agencies. One of the things that we are happy and we can report is that distributing agencies, which were part-time until now, as from January next year, they are going to be appointed full-time. It is the matter that we are discussing with the DG, the DDGs, so that we have one approach, and it must be a seamless transition. In other words, beneficiaries should not be disadvantaged. Well, up to so far, we have distributed more than 18 billion, because every year from the operator we receive an income of 1.6 billion. But when we receive it, we don't distribute. We invest it and distribute the next year. So that's why in our financial statements you'll find that we distribute sometimes 2 billion or 2.1, 2.3, depending on the interest after the investment. Well, the full-time DAs have already touched it, but one important thing about the new act, the amended act, is education and awareness. For the first time that Parliament and our department, the shareholder, has given us the opportunity to move around the country to educate and to make people aware of the finding of the funding that is within us. And I must indicate that until now, our footprint is felt in all provinces. We have opened offices in the 9 provinces. So I think the next step is to look at satellite offices. We have signed a memorandum of agreement with most stakeholders on the ground. For example, the House of Traditional Leaders. We have signed an agreement with the lawyers and the chartered accountants, so that they can help our beneficiaries. One of the things that the amended act also helps us to speed up our work is the proactive funding. And I think the CEO or the commissioner will try to elaborate on the proactive funding. We are now finalizing the framework of proactive funding, because we know that most people cannot apply. Some people don't have the chance or the knowledge to fill in the form. So the commission will be able to go out and identify projects. These projects might be identified because the minister would have said, go and make a research on this area, on education or the arts, and the commission will go and make such a research. The other thing in the amended act is the differentiated grants. We are happy that grants are now differentiated. In other words, we're going to have a small grant that is from 0 to 500,000 rand. The medium grant from 500,000 to 5 million. Large grant is 5 million upwards. And you'll recall that for now we have gone out, we have issued a call for the advert, the charity advert and the arts advert. In terms of the guidelines, I think the public is now well aware where can I apply, how can I apply. If I'm a small organization, my organization has been registered for 6 months, you have the opportunity to apply, but you have to gauge yourself according to the strength that you can report, because there is no use for a small organization to get a very big grant which they cannot report to the NLC. Well, the number of distributing agencies will be determined by the budget that we allocate to such distributing agencies. So the number might be 6, 7, 8, but it won't be as we used to work with them in the old act. Implementation program or process of the appointment of the DAs, that is distributing agencies, will be run by the Department of Trade and Industry, and we are happy that we are talking about how we can phase in the distributing agencies. I will hand now to the commissioner to deal with the proactive funding. Well, the issue of the license, I think I will give a summary when we finish, which will be the last item.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, DG, Group COO, my colleague, good morning. Now, in terms of the proactive funding process, the Chair has already indicated that this could be determined by the Minister, but it's not about choosing a place where this should happen and just making a proposal that a particular project or area should be funded. It will be done in such a way that a project or an area will be identified either by the Minister in terms of Section 24(3)A of the Lotteries Act, or that could be determined by the National Lotteries Commission's Board. When that request is received, research will have to be conducted first before a proposal can be put together and be tabled before the adjudicating panel for them to determine whether it's a worthy project that should be funded. Other processes are underway at the moment because the Act further stipulates that there should be policies that govern how this area is funded. The Chairperson spoke about differentiated grants, and he will, in summary, talk about the lottery license. Now, let's get to the issue of our fourth quarter performance share. In terms of the strategic objectives, I won't take you through the vision, which everybody knows that our vision is to be a catalyst for social upliftment, and the mission we have presented before together with our values. But I'm going to focus on the strategic objectives and how they have performed up to the fourth quarter. But before I do that, let me just indicate a few highlights that throughout the fourth quarter, we prepared for the transition from NLB to NLC. we got the approval of the ICT enhancement. I had indicated earlier about the process of modernizing the organization, that amongst other things, for the past 15 years, we've had technology that had not been improved, and it wasn't meeting the needs of the beneficiaries who were serving. We're busy with those enhancements. We have completed the grant funding business process, which is an important process that was linked to the opportunity we would have identified with the implementation of the amended legislation. We have piloted a project to see how we can actually prepare our applications from the different provinces, and we can inform the House that with the two calls that the chairperson mentioned, amongst other things, we'll be having four provinces that will be processing those applications, and by the time they get to the head office, they'll be ready for adjudication and processing. We've increased the national footprint. We spoke earlier on about the provincial services, and that was just meant to take services to the people. And we have also managed to get approval from the board on the business continuity plan, which would have been an outstanding project for a while. In terms of how we performed, Chair, I will not take the committee through this slide. I usually find it a bit boring for us to be reading the strategic objectives and the targets and where we have achieved, except for going to the one area which I would have highlighted when we presented our third quarter report, that we were starting to identify problems or challenges with meeting a strategic, one of the areas of strategic objective four, which is the allocation of 5% grant funding to the different provinces. There would have been a lot of interest in the provinces that were not meeting or where we were not delivering in terms of that. We indicated the issues to the committee that, amongst other things, it was about, one, whether the particular provinces had enough NPOs and NGOs registered. But secondly, also, it was about the population of the different provinces. And thirdly, it was about us going in to do developmental work. Hence, in the amended legislation, I think there's that area which talks to education and awareness, and we've worked our targets around how we need to do that. Chairperson and the honorable members will see that there would have been a bit of an improvement. We nearly met that target with the Free State. It's at 4.69. Mpumalanga is at 4.35. And it's only the Northern Cape that was at 2.65. Later, our senior executive for grant funding will talk about a whole strategy that has been developed and is aligned to the new legislation, and we're committing to meeting that important target because it talks to our delivery, or not only our delivery, but the delivery of the mandate. And out of those 17 indicators, we have achieved 16, and it's only that one where we couldn't achieve, with the performance percentage of 94. Now, just briefly, the other area where we would have made strides or improved would be in the area of communication. I think for the past 3 years or so, we have worked on the issue of bad publicity or negative publicity, and we have set ourselves targets in terms of how we measure that. And we can report that throughout the year, coverage, inclusive of all media-related mentions of Kidani, Ituba Holdings, as well as industry-related items, would have improved even during the time when we were starting to experience challenges on matters which were reported around Kidani and Ituba. The NLC still managed to operate above 15% cap that we would have set as a target, that wouldn't go below 12% in terms of negative reporting. Our equity status hasn't changed from the previous quarter. It remains as it was when we presented. An important area that the chairperson spoke about earlier on, which is part of our mandate, and we always focus a lot on grant funding and seldom really concentrate on the regulatory area of the lottery operator or processes. We have a unit that monitors compliance of the lottery operator, and during the period under review, they made sure that they audit things like availability of tickets to participants, live lotto and Powerball draws. Our staff attend those draws all the time. Continuation in revenue generation by the operator, because we have to ensure that for every ticket that is sold out there, the lottery commission gets what it's supposed to get in terms of the percentage that goes to it. Ensuring security over scratch cards, payment of revenue into NLDTF, the prize validation and payment of winners, winners counseling and protection of their identity, as well as safeguarding the integrity of the National Lottery as we were going through the period of transition, especially in the fourth quarter. That became an area where we focused on a lot. And we do have beneficiary relations area that also looks into player relations with the objective of making sure that we don't only protect our beneficiaries, but we do also protect lottery players. Furthermore, Chair, this area also looks at an important issue that we would have reported previously of illegal lotteries, and when necessary, they've been able to serve those who were operating illegally with compliance notices. They would have received undertakings from them that they would stop operating illegally. We've had instances where letters of demand were served and advice to those wishing to register or comply with the Act, there would be some of those people who approached the regulator and said, how can we make sure that we comply and we are allowed to operate in this space? And when necessary, we've been working with the law enforcement agencies to ensure that we deal with this issue of illegal lotteries. We also have established a monitoring and evaluation unit which developed tools, because it's been about not reporting that we have distributed 18 or 20 billion only. It's about the impact and for us to give an idea of where those beneficiaries are, except for the recipients of the money, but those people who have benefited from the project. And in the annual report that we'll be presenting soon, I think there's a clear indication, there are figures and information on how that has been achieved. Okay. At the moment, let me hand over to my colleague, Mr. Jeffrey Dupree, to just take honorable members through information pertaining to grant funding.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair and members. I'll be brief, Chair, just to indicate, firstly, the allocations, which obviously the CFO's financial information contain more detail, but total allocations that was done in the financial year amount to 1.4 billion, and that amount is split against those different sectors as per the slide, Chair, and I don't think I'll go into the detail of that, but you could see, obviously, that in terms of the variance report later on, the CFO will talk to some of the key factors that led to some of those variances. But that was basically the total allocated from the available budget of 2.2 billion. And the number of beneficiaries that 1.4 billion represent is 1,921, and that number is split across those sectors as indicated in the second last column from your right. Chair, the next slide, I'm not going to talk to detail, but focus was a in the performance information, indication was already given by the commissioner in terms of those provinces where we failed 25%. What I would just like to briefly indicate, Chairperson, that part of the strategy to on a more sustainable address that particular achievement of the 5%, as members would recall the previous year, for the first time actually we've done that. And part of that strategy, I think, has already been alluded to by the Commissioner and the Chairperson, because we'd like to believe the proactive funding mechanism that yourselves as legislators have provided, the Commission will assist us in that particular regard, because it will, as indicated by the Commissioner, through a very structured process, obviously allow us to proactively identify, especially in those provinces that we are struggling to achieve the 5%, to be able to support worthy projects. In that regard, we are in the process of establishing a research function. We've already gone out in the process of getting a request for proposals, and I think the supply chain management division is now evaluating. I think we received about 30 proposals, and we will be obviously finalizing that process shortly. What we've done in the meantime, also, Chair, is just to ask our provincial managers through desktop research, start looking at the key government documents, looking at the profile of the sector, of the NGO sector in the particular provinces, look at what is the more active areas and sectors of those particular NGOs, so that when we then also implement our targeted calls, which is also one of the instruments used in this particular regard, we can be able to inform the agencies about the profile of the sector in that particular province. And Chair, you would notice from the current ARTS call, part of the certification there is to try and also test this particular approach, whereby we have clustered those four provinces that we historically struggled with, Northwest, Northern Cape, Mpumalanga, and Northwest. For example, they have started with them as the first group of applications. So we would then see also, because what the distributing agencies are also doing is that as part of the adjudication process, trying to prioritize the processing of applications from those provinces so that we can also help to achieve that. Furthermore, Chair, the education and awareness program is being intensified, and even during the calls, we are trying to focus and be positively discriminating towards those provinces that will be struggling in terms of the number of workshops and as well as the help desk that we will be. And lastly, Chair, I think with the opening of the provincial offices, we will be better placed in terms of proximity to be able to provide better targeted assistance to our organization, especially the new entrants and the emerging organizations, to try and deal on a sustainable basis with the issue of meeting the legislative mandate of minimum of 5%. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. My name is Philemon Litwaba, and I am the CFO for the Commission. Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, the DG, the Chairperson of the Commission and my Commissioner, I greet you all. I will be taking you through the financial information, and I hope everyone can see that slide there. Let me start with the second information, Chairperson, that most of the question emanates from in many meetings that we go through. The nature of our organization being one of its objectives, that of giving grants, revenue remains a concern. And in the last meeting, when we came here, we did indicate that it is one of the things that we are monitoring very closely to ensure that the organizations don't suffer out there due to the decline in revenue. And I'm happy to indicate that the revenue has remained fairly stable. On the lottery ticket sales, and this is the sales generated by the national lottery operator, the total for 2014-15 came to 4.5 billion, and I must indicate these are audited numbers. and I understand we are coming here again on the 28th to come and present the annual report, and hence we did not include the audit report. But it's just for the interest of the members is that we have received an unqualified audit opinion, and irregular expenditure is not one of the matters that did not make us to achieve a clean audit. So the contribution, which is one of the key things that we are driving, we have actually got 1.5 billion coming from the total lottery sales, and members would know that that is the 34% contribution from the lottery operator. In terms of the grant allocation, the Commission continues to close that gap. You'll recall lately that there have been issues in terms of the NGO sector, that these funding issues, but will remain a key contributor into the sectors in terms of our contribution. We did allocate, as the senior executive manager indicated, 1.4 billion in the 2014-15 financial year. The chairperson indicated that as one of the things that we're doing to ensure that we enhance our revenue, we do invest these revenues that we're getting from the national lottery operator. And this assists us in terms of supplementing that which we are receiving. In terms of those investments, we have, for 2014-15 financial year, received the interest of 284 million coming out of those investment strategies. On the financial ratios, Chairperson, liquidity is one of the key things within our organization. As you know, cash we cannot survive without, because we don't want to keep the organizations not having the money. So as and when approvals are made, payments have to be made. We therefore monitor closely our liquidity ratios. Chair, I'm able to indicate that we are looking very positive in terms of our ratios, and we continue to monitor them. One of the key things that we also look at in terms of our ratios is how much we are spending, the expenditure, vis-a-vis the percentage of the total revenue that we are receiving. And that we are monitoring it primarily because we are saying we shouldn't be expending all the money that we are receiving from the operator in our investments significantly on our operations, because we want to maximize the contributions to the NGO sectors. And therefore, our target, we are saying, we need to manage that expenditure at 18% level, I mean at 20% level as a target. We are happy to say that for the 2014-15 financial year, our operating expenditure has remained below that target. We are at 18%. Moving on, next slide, Chair, talks to our financial performance. I've indicated that our revenue will remain fairly at 1.5 billion, but there has been a slight decrease of 3% in terms of our revenue versus the budget that we are expecting. The grants allocated, I did indicate, but there is a significant variance if you look at what we had budgeted for to distribute compared to what we had actually distributed or allocated. The reasons I will indicate in the next slide, Chair. Compensation to employees. We have not overspent on that line, purely because some of the positions within the provinces that we intended to fill on that 4% did not materialize, and that is going to happen in the current financial year. On goods and services, Chair, we've underspent on that, but that also, as indicated, relates to some of the budgeted expenditures that were supposed to be expended in the provinces. That strategy is going very well. Next slide talks to the variance analysis. I did indicate that there was a slight decrease in terms of the revenue that we had collected from the operator, and the reasons as indicated by the operator is to do with market forces. The grant expenditure funding, what has happened today, that 30% under allocation is through the leadership of the chairperson and the commissioner. We have decided in October last year to supplement the budget to do additional allocations in different sectors. And that we then had a call last year. We had a special call last year within the charities targeting the ECD buildings and the sports. But then the response in terms of those calls came late in the year, and hence that budget is only getting expected in the current financial year.
You will be returning to us very soon on this matter. I'm going to ask you to leave it there for the moment, and also just simply to thank you for making that input.
Thank you.
And I see, is this Mr. Lidwaba?
Lidwaba,
yes. Yeah, the Chief Financial Officer.
That's correct.
We'll be seeing you again shortly, and you can go into greater detail on this. Thank you. So what we'll do right now is to go back a little final closure from yourself, either chairperson or commissioner.
Thank you, Chairperson. We need to inform the Chairperson and the House that in terms of our operations, the board has started the request for proposal in July 2013, and they released such proposal for organization to apply to run the lottery in South Africa. And we had so many companies in our bidding process. I think there were more than 20 who showed the interest, but those who brought back the documents were only 4. And we embarked on a process which was a lengthy process, and it culminated that to a point where the information was given to the department, to the minister, and the department or the minister, as instructed by the Act, awarded the license to Ituva Holdings. The new operator started business on the 1st of June 2015. We are assessing the operator, and we will come to this house. I think next time when we come here, we'll give you the operation for 3 months or 4 months, whether we are satisfied or not satisfied. But as of now, the NLDTF, National Lottery Distribution Trust Fund, is still receiving enough money that it will stay. It will stand any tested time that may come. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Now, members, it's over to yourselves. Just a little reminder, though, that we will be seeing the NLC again shortly, to interrogate the annual report after we've engaged the Auditor General. Just a little reminder on that one. But let's go over to yourselves by show of hands, Honourable Mkongi, Honourable Albert, Honourable Williams, Honourable Hill-Lewis, Honourable Matiasi. Can we try the issue of a couple of minutes? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chairperson. I also welcome the report. I want to check on the question of the value for money. Value for money that you give for projects, the monitoring mechanisms. What are the monitoring mechanisms that are there to see that there is value for the money? No, it's not a project type of a project, you know, which does not reflect what was in the business plan of that organization. Two, we know that South Africa is a pool or has a pool of poverty, and our people are not skilled to deal with money, the majority. And you spoke about winners counseling. I was just interested, how many of the winners, you know, have squandered these monies? Do you have a mechanism of knowing, of following up each and every winner to see, I mean, how is this? Because I have a case, a living case there in Kugulethu, you know, where now is a serious challenge to community after so much millions. Lastly, you presented a slide in the TTI with some sort of wrong information, and we corrected that information about provinces. When you are counting about provinces, it was Northern Cape, Northwest, and Western Cape. 2 weeks after that, fortunately, I went to the Portfolio Committee on Arts and Culture. The same slide was used. I didn't comment about it. And I was patiently looking at that slide. I waited for that. It came. And it was wrong. I left it. So how do you really look at correct information that you present to the nation? Because that thing is very serious, that we give the nation wrong information. And if we are corrected, we do not correct that information. Because we corrected the trading industry. You came back to Parliament 2 weeks after that, to attend the Chairperson sent me there, and that slide was there. Lastly, now we have 4.5 billion as compared to what? I was not Member of Parliament last year. I arrived there in 2014. So I don't know, will you compare 4.5 to what? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Nkongi. Right, Honourable Elvis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to know on page 9 regarding proactive funding process, what criteria you actually use to establish whether a project can get the go-ahead for funding. Then, a few pages on with regard to your employment numbers, I don't see any people with disabilities mentioned in here, and I don't see any people employed from the white male category. Would there be any reason for that? And then lastly, on the allocations to the various provinces, let me just find that slide. I see Northwest province received 25 million for arts and culture, charities 27, so there's almost more money given, or equal amount of money given to arts and culture than charities. Now, given the financial or economic state of South Africa, I would like to know why that is the case. And then the same for the Western Cape. You find that 78 million rand has been allocated to arts and culture, and just short in front of it, 116 for charities. And given the poverty levels in both these provinces, why would that be the case? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Albert. Yes, was it Honourable Williams at that point then? Yes, thank you.
Thanks, Jefferson. I'm going to raise the issue that I always raise. Every time I sit in front of you, I ask about Mpumalanga, longer, and it seems that we still haven't reached that 5%, and you have said there is some emphasis on that, but I think you can increase that. I'd also like to know why Mpumalanga doesn't feature in this document about the beneficiary payments, and neither does the Northern Cape. So they did receive between them around 7%, but they don't feature in this document. Just one last thing on this. On slide 30, one of the reasons you give for failing to reach the 5% is that the less dense population in those underperforming provinces. So I'd like you to explain to me what the difference is on density of population between Mpumalanga, which only got 4.35% of the allocation, and Limpopo, which got nearly 15% of the allocation. And how do you justify using that excuse when Mpumalanga and Limpopo have got similar population densities and distribution, and such a big variant in the allocation of the grants to them? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Yes, Honourable
Gaddafi?
Thanks, Honorable Chair. In the last appearance and in the last presentation, we made a request that the spread in terms of provinces and all of that should not only be indicated in number of millions of, that you have distributed. It must also indicate who are the specific beneficiaries, so that in our oversight responsibilities, we are able to touch base with beneficiaries on the ground themselves and get the feedback from them. And this has not been fully complied with, but partly would want to know why. These figures mean nothing to us because they are not enabling to put our fingers on the actual beneficiary. But then secondly, would want to know if your lottery programs, have they maintained the momentum as when the lottery was launched 14, 15 years ago? And if there's been a decline, and what are the causes of such a decline? Because the causes of that could be because of declining levels of incomes and are people getting impoverished day in and day out. We are seeing that you have adjudicated over so many applications, and two-thirds of the applications that you have received have been declined. And we want to know, because some of these cases, some of these applications are now before the courts, in which beneficiaries or prospective beneficiaries are exerting pressure on you to allocate them these funds. When are we going to change from being pressurizers, the state and as government? We fail to do our work and we force ordinary people to go to court as an act of last resort to seek assistance. Each time when our people have got to be helped is only when they go to courts to seek for assistance. Why should it be like that? These are the few questions we'd like you to answer. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Honourable Matiasi. Honourable Hill Lewis.
Just to say, Professor, the best thing that you've done in this quarter is that you've issued a new call for applications, which I thought you should have mentioned, and that's something to be welcomed. It's the first call the first general call that you've made. You've made some specific calls, but it's the first general call you've made in, I think it's more than 2 years, maybe more than 3 years. No, not quite that long, yeah. 2 years, yeah. I'm very, very glad to see that you've done that. But can you tell us what your new target is for the processing of those applications? Because I presume now that you will have the extra capacity of the permanent DAs that you will be able to process those much faster. But are you able to make some form of commitment to the general public and to applicants as to what the new turnaround time on their applications will be, so that they can have some kind of expectation as to the new service level standards they will receive from the NLC? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Hill Lewis. Now it's over to yourself, Professor and Commissioner, to respond to those, preferably in 10 minutes, otherwise maximum 15 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson and the members for the questions. The Commissioner, the grant funding and CFO, in terms of the specificity of the questions, they will also join me. When it comes to winners, here in South Africa, there is a law that says you cannot disclose the name of a winner. In one day, thugs can visit and burn his house. So therefore, winners are protected by law. It's up to a winner if he wants to go publicly. But I can attest that when Gidani was when Utingo was operating, they had a section where they do counseling. I know of a person who has won 10 million in my area, and when Gidani took over, he had already finished that 10 million. And he won the first Powerball in South Africa. That was 30 million. So they had to embark on a serious counseling for that person to not to squander the money. So they are protected. The wrong slide, honorable member, I think the commissioner and the officials will deal with that. The proactive funding, yes, we are working on a framework, and I think we are about to finalize it so that at least we can know which area can we put emphasis on. And I think it ties up to the honorable member who asked about Mpumalanga and other provinces. We want to use this this portion of proactive funding in order to address those provinces which are not making 5%. The problem we are facing is that the funding is application based. If a person doesn't apply, no one from the commission can go with the form and say apply. It is up to the person. And now, with the proactive funding, it will help us to incite them so that they can know they applied and they will apply. And I think the other problem is that most of the applications are declined because they don't meet the requirements. And it will be wrong for us to allow an application which has failed in the requirement stage to the next stage. Otherwise, there is no need for people to apply. Let's rather give them money like SASA. Less performing provinces, well, it is up to those provinces, but we. The board has commissioned a research just to check whether people are able to fill in the forms correctly or whether they understand this. And I've realized, Jefferson, the thing of application is so difficult that even myself or any member who was in parliament cannot understand that thing unless you know how to draw the proposal. I'm talking this because one member who was here, this is the third year, not making it correctly. And I think we are going to make sure that we assist that member to for the community to benefit. The momentum of Lotto, since what happened globally, the performance has gone down worldwide. When Utingo started in South Africa, many people played Lotto, and when Gidani took over, the number dropped down. And now when Ituba is operating, you can see the trend that it's not so much down, but it shows that people are now starting not to play Lotto as like when it started. There are so many programs like those that are coming from gambling board, casinos, keynotes, which some of the games are supposed to be supposed to be done by the operator. the two-thirds declined, it is primarily of not meeting the requirements, the documents, registration, financial statements. But I'm happy that the amended act has now lessened the burden. That's why I think, Honorable Lewis, I think our performance will be judged by what you honorable members gave us to say. There should be grants of 500,000, 5 million, and 10 million. I think, and the appointment of the distributing agencies will be full time. Although it is coming with a heavy burden on the commission, because as we calculated, it will add 46 million burden to the lottery commission. That is the amount that we need to pay. So I think I can commit that when we start in January, we'll be able to calculate how many months can we finish the applications.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I think one of the most important questions that the Honorable Member asked on value for money is a question that was asked even previously. And the panel that actually came, so when you look at the value chain of or the process that the application form follows, we take it that by the time it gets adjudicated, that has already been determined. Let me just cite an example with the ECD course. Because it was about building creches for different communities and in areas which are far away from where we're operating, we sent our monitoring and evaluating teams to go and check those issues, whether one, there was land which existed, where the people would be able to build when funded, but secondly also whether they had people with the requisite skills to do that for them, and if not, we've had to introduce them to other entities like the IDT so that they can be assisted. So it's an issue that we are focusing on. And in terms of what happens when the implementation process happens, we have signed a memorandum of understanding with an NGO that deals with unemployed graduates. And we've been identifying especially unemployed graduates who have skills in finance and legal, and have actually sent them to the different projects to go and assist with the necessary capacity building, or to make sure that whatever is indicated in the grant agreement gets implemented and to the core. The issue of equity, I think that there's a lot of work which would have happened just as we were finishing the fourth quarter. A case in point is the appointment of people with disabilities and the white male. We indicated earlier on that with the opportunity that would be presented by the new provincial offices, as we are making appointments, so that's where we're trying to balance or to correct areas where we're having problems. I think that's all. Decline of applications and applications that, or applicants that have taken us to court, we're trying to capacitate our applicants, but in terms of those that are in court at the moment, I think we've just come out of the legal committee. I don't remember having, with the recent meeting, any presentation of applicants who are taking us to court because the applications have been declined. We take them through a process so that we can explain what has happened and, where possible, try to capacitate them.
The other thing, Chairperson, that members may also help us is that we, in terms of the new acts and the regulations, it gives us how many days an application must stay But the problem is, honourable members, we have issued the call last month. Up to now, I don't think we have received 1,000 applications. More applications, maybe 10,000, will come on the last week. And that gives the Commission a problem. How do you separate applications that came on the last day? And usually, when somebody submits on the last day, the second week, he phones, how far is my application? When he knows that it is first come, first serve. So that's the problem we are. And I think all of us together, it is our responsibility, DTI, and the honorable members too, to penetrate the communities to say, when it is application, it's not like applying for a job wherein you can submit your application on the last day and you'll still be selected. Here, please make sure that your application becomes the first.
Thanks, Chair. I just want to deal with these three questions here. Maybe just to add on what the Commissioner has said in terms of the matters that are before the court. I think it's very important to indicate that the Commission is not being taken to court because we are not adjudicating. While we accept that there is a problem in terms of the backlog which we have presented the plan in the previous meeting in terms of how we're dealing with, the organizations that takes us to court, it is because of decisions that the adjudication committee has made, a deadline. And given those cases, if we also believe that the organization is not meeting the requirement, and they decide that we have a process internally in terms of how we deal with grievances, the review committee, but people sometimes choose not to even opt for that option, to go straight to court. And as an organization, I think it's upon us to ensure that we defend if we so believe that that decision that the organization has reached was correct. But also, the second question that I want to deal with is the issue of payments in Mpumalanga. Maybe let me just give in terms of the figures. The organization has paid in the current financial year 1.7 billion in total for not allocations, the actual payment. I think the member was asking, the honorable member was asking around the actual payment. There is a percentage that has been paid to Mpumalanga, and that percentage is 4% out of the 1.7 billion. And all the other provinces, we do have that information if needed. The 4.5 billion compared to what? We have budgeted 4.7 billion in terms of the total revenue from the operator, and I think it's important that we indicate that the 4.7 billion is not the revenue to the NLC. It is the revenue anticipated to be generated by the operator. What comes to the NLC is a percentage thereof. Last year it was 37%. In the current financial year, it's expected to be 27%. So it is in relation to that 4.7 billion. But historically, we have been at 4.5, 4.6 billion, and the actual figure for last year is 4.569 billion, as it's included in the presentation. And I think there was a last question that dealt with the number of days. In mathematical terms, it's 240 days. We've got 150 days in terms of what has been legislated and within the regulations from the date we receive the application up until the adjudication. We have got 30 days to give the applicant a period to return the signed grant agreement and 60 days to payment. However, as indicated, we are anticipating that once the distributing agencies are permanent, obviously we are not going to be very strict on that time. It could be even earlier, but this is the legislative time period, if that is important in terms of the. Yeah, sure. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
thank you very much for that input. I just, anything else will have to come back in writing, and our time is exhausted. But just two things here. Pardon?
I took all your applications. Yesterday I went to my constituents, I distributed those applications. What I need assistance for filling those forms. Our people, they do not know how to fill the forms. I will need that assistance. Thank you very much. It's George and Liza.
I'm going to make a general ruling on this. I think all of these issues, there is already a commitment that the NLB, through the proactive clause, as it were, which only kicked in on the 14th of April of this year, so that's very little time. They are now, have told us today, they are determined to implement such a process. So what I think will be better for us is to send formal requests for constituencies to the NLC and ensure that this is done. I certainly will be tracking that because it's part of a new clause which was intended to address this issue. Honourable Hill Lewis, I hope it's not the same thing because we're trying to close off. I think no more questions, but you may pose the question in writing. That's what I'm saying. They're going to come back in writing.
Okay.
But not only that, can I make myself clear, Honourable Hill Lewis? They will be here shortly. They will be coming again.
Yes, I'm aware they're coming next week, but I just want to check, should I send the question to them or to you?
No, it comes through. This is part of the committee meeting. We want Mr. Hermans to send them the outstanding questions immediately. And members, just a little reminder, whenever these entities or the DTI visit us, if you still have an outstanding question, please forward it to Mr. Hermans, who makes me aware of them before he processes them, so that you're not leaving any critical issues out. I was going to say just two things. Thank you very much for giving us this requested list of who these beneficiaries are. But I did notice that Mpumalanga Charities, or Art, Culture and National Heritage, slipped in between Limpopo Sports and Charities. Now, I'm not sure if that applies to the rest of the book, because the rest of the book seemed to be focused province by province. And that affects pages that I've seen, 91, 101 and 102. I couldn't see anything else for Mpumalanga after that, so they may well have been. So that addresses that book. And just to indicate to members, you were not at the meeting when this request was made. That was made by your colleague, Honourable Matiasi, a request for this schedule of beneficiaries. So please make him aware, the Honourable Shabambu. All right? On that note, I want to, before I leave just now, to wish all of the women present here today, but all of the women of South Africa, a very happy Women's Month, and to take the men who work with them for their relationship, which involves respect, professionalism, and a recognition that women have much to offer. Thank you to all of you. It's important that you set a good example in our country, given the domestic abuse and abuse in the workplace. On that note, may I ask the DG to accept that I will be leaving. I could have left at 5:30, but I don't want to interrupt the flow. And that is on a personal matter that I am attending to. And I will ask the Honourable Kalako to please take the chair. I also want to ask Honourable Hill Lewis, if you've got the question handy, let's factor it in now. Great, thank you. So thank you to everyone present here, and I'll take my leave. I'll see you tomorrow. Thank you.
members and TGI colleagues, I think we can start. We have not adjourned the meeting. We have just finished, we're finishing. Over to you, TG. Those who are leaving, have a safe trip. We can leave quietly. TG.
Thank you, Honorable Kalako. We've been asked to do the presentation on what is called Operation Bakisa. So the presentation will be done. I'll deal with the first few slides, and then it will be Ms. Sukiswa Hapai who will do the presentation. I think let me maybe get straight into the matter. We'll quickly just take you through some of the background and then some of the immediate initiatives which are currently underway as part of this Operation Bakisa, the ocean economy, and how we can get growth moving to 5%. I think just by way of background, let me explain what Operation Bakisa is. We're coming forward with the strategies. It is a methodology which was developed by in Malaysia by McKinsey's when Malaysia Airlines was going through a major crisis like our SAA, but even worse was Malaysia Airlines. And McKinsey then intervened with a massive turnaround plan for Malaysia Airlines, and that became then, it was adopted by government, which they call big fast results. And we call it Bakisa, Kauleza, whatever way of it, going fast, getting fast results. So this is basically for government. It's really a methodology which has two key components. The one is that instead of a linear form of consultation, like we currently do with any policy position or strategy, we have consultation with the public, with stakeholders, we go to NEDLAC, we come to Parliament, and then we implement the plan. This is what they call syndication. All the stakeholders, government, private sector, academics, whoever has an interest in a particular matter, they get put into a room for 3 weeks together and they resolve all possible policy coordination problems. And then the second part is, so it's a syndicated, concentrated consultation process by all the role players in a particular issue. And then secondly, they develop what is called 3 feet deep plans. That is, it can't be vague principles, vision statements, what do you call it, wishes and so on. It must be actually 3 foot deep plans on exactly who's going to do what and so on. So there's been currently, there's 3 Bakisas. The one was the oceans economy, there was one on health, and there currently is one on the mining sector, which is going down. So that is basically what, and then there was extensive areas on the following 4 areas. So as I said, out of the operation, Bakisa, Zukiso will take you through some of the plans, but it's basically been 4 areas which has been focused on under the ocean economy. One is oil and gas, marine protection, marine transport and manufacturing, and aquaculture. DTI is really principally engaged in the one on marine transport and manufacturing. That is the main one, shipbuilding, boat building, and then the second one, and then where we are also involved in is in the oil and gas, especially the development of the Saldanha oil and gas repair hub, and then we also have a role to play in the aquaculture, because as you know, we have the agriculture support program. But Zukiso will give you a bit more. Let me then just highlight some of the key breakthroughs that was made at this operation, Bakisa. The first thing we managed to unlock is really 2 major port developments, which is the one at Kuha and the one at Saldanha. Now, before, if you recall, we've got 2 IDZs. The one IDZ is here in Saldanha, which we launched, and we wanted with the Western Cape government and the Saldanha municipality, we want to develop Saldanha as a major oil
and rig repair facility. And then we've got Kucha, which is a generalized IDZ, but also our key plan was to get a manganese terminal located at Kucha and to do massive shipments of our manganese reserves. There was always a major dispute with this because in terms of Transnet, they preferred, because it would give them more income, is to bring the manganese down from the Northern Cape and take it out via Saldanha. So they wanted to designate Saldanha as the gas, as the manganese terminal, because it was quick, it was cheap, they can use the existing lines. So that was a major dispute, and that's why we had to delay the IDZ. We had numerous disputes with them over 4 or 5 years, and especially in the past few years, while we were designating Saldanha, and we couldn't get Kucha moving. So at this operation for Kisa, because we had Transnet in the room, because we had the Saldanha IDZ people, we had the Kucha people, and so on, we had DTI, we had all the departments, public enterprises, we were able to unblock this thing. So what you have seen now is that I think a week ago, 2 weeks ago, the president launched the Saldanha oil and gas terminal. They've already started the construction for the Saldanha is now designated by Transnet as the oil facility. And over 9 billion has been unlocked for that from public and private sector. The second thing is last week Cabinet also endorsed the issuing of the license for Kucha to be designated as a manganese terminal. That will, we see, it will unlock not only the Western Cape now, but it will unlock the whole Northern Cape, because they have to firstly repair the rail line, which is 2.3 billion will be invested in upgrading the Northern Cape to Port, the port in the Eastern Cape, 2.3 billion. But they will also then, as I said, construct a terminal, and also we have beneficiation projects, because the Chinese have got mines which they have in the Northern Cape. They bring the manganese now down to Kucha, we'll be able to create the beneficiation of manganese and so on. So this is just an example of how Operation Pakisa has unlocked two important IDZs. The second one that has been unlocked is in the question of our shipbuilding by our Navy and by Arms Corps. There's two, what happened out of the Pakisa again? As you know, DTI has been on a vigorous campaign to get designations for to use government procurement to build our industry or to rebuild our industry. But as you know, there are many negative people who have said we don't have the capabilities to build these, firstly, these research vessels, and we don't have the to build the ships for our Navy, and we can't do bigger ships, and so on. So what we had in that room, during the Operation Pakisa, we had the DTI, we had National Treasury, we had the actual ship manufacturers were in the meeting. So, and as you know, the DTI's request for designation was laying with Treasury for almost 9 months, 10 months, where they didn't want to, because they weren't sure about the capabilities we have as a country. So in that room itself, we had the manufacturers who were able to explain how they could build these ships. A week after that, this matter was resolved. We had Minister Jeff Khadebe there, we had others, and we immediately resolved this issue. So the designation notes was issued, and we have 60% local content. And now we have, as is indicated here, Project Hotel, Project Biro, the South African Navy and Defense Force have issued these tenders and are busy with processing those proposals. But what it will mean is we will be able to revitalize our shipbuilding industry. And again, we will then unlock one another IDZ, which is the Richards Bay IDZ. And of course, we always have Simonstown here, but there will be specific work redesignating the Richards Bay IDZ to look at our ship repair. So I'm just giving those few highlights of what Operation Pakis has already achieved. I'll hand over to Zukiswa.
Thank you, DG. Honorable members, just to continue from where the DG has left off. Operation Pakistan identified a number of interventions which are aimed at addressing some of the challenges that the maritime sector is facing. I must say that the maritime sector has been a neglected child in South Africa, but in the advent of Operation Pakistan, we have seen it given the attention that it deserves. What the maritime sector has set as its vision, it looks to increase the sector's contribution to GDP to about 23 billion in 2019. We're also looking at creating jobs, increasing jobs to about 50,000 within the sector. We're looking at increasing the market share of South African companies to 30%. Currently, what we see in the oil and gas sector, we are capturing about 5% of market share. And within the boat building and the catamarans, we are capturing about 0.24% of the global share. The challenges that we're looking at addressing within the maritime space, I think these have been well publicized. The issue of obsolete and inadequate and expensive infrastructure to support manufacturing, and you combine this with operational deficiencies within our port system. There's also been a serious failure to invest in supportive infrastructure by Transnet. Another challenge that we're looking at within the maritime space is the issue of shortage of artisans and professional skills, and limited support for market growth from public procurement. Hence, the DGI went on the exercise of designating shipbuilding for public procurement. Another limit or constraint to us growing this sector is the issue of the national registry, where in South Africa we do not have any ships that are registered in our national registry. In order to address these challenges, which I've just alluded to, and to also accelerate growth within the sector, the lab identified the maritime lab identified about 18 initiatives within the marine transport manufacturing. And I think the idea behind this is to create a supportive environment and also to improve funding within this sector so that we can fast track the some of the infrastructure projects that the DG has alluded to. And some of the initiatives are looking at addressing skills within the shipbuilding sector. Because our research shows that this is not a sector of choice amongst learners. Many students are not sort of aware of the opportunities that are within the maritime space. Hence, there are initiatives to create awareness along the schooling system so that students can choose this as a field of choice. Obviously, we have to emphasize science and math for any for those students that are looking to participate in the sector. Some of the initiatives are looking at encouraging the establishment of an SA flag fleet for coastal and international shipping. We are also looking at developing a market
where we can support that by creating demand through public procurement, because this is an important lever that we can, that we have at our disposal as government to resuscitate our industrial capabilities in a number of sectors. And we're also looking at building strong private sector partnerships between government and the private sector. These are some of the three features that the Operation Takisa came up with under the marine transport manufacturing. Under the first stream, we have those initiatives that are the responsibility of Transnet and the Department of Public Enterprise, which are looking into developing the infrastructure and improving the efficiencies of operations in those in the number of ports within South Africa. The second stream is looking at skills and capacity building, and these are the initiatives which are led by the Department of Higher Education and Training. The third stream is looking at increasing market growth, where DTI is paying into this space, where we are responsible for the initiatives 15 and 16, where we're looking at creating and implementing a public procurement and localization program. We're also looking at developing a strategic marketing campaign and a value proposition for target markets. What we're looking for there, we're looking at marketing the services that our institutions can provide, the offerings for investors that are looking into investing into South Africa, and also looking at what are the capabilities within the maritime space. Because if you look at, for example, in Africa, a number of countries are looking at rehabilitating their port systems. They are investing in infrastructure. They are procuring a new vessels. What we want to be, we want to be the country of choice. Just to take you through progress to date with respect to the marine transport and manufacturing, I think the DG has already alluded to this point, whereby TNPA has adopted a public private partnership model to finance the new operation Pakistan infrastructure in a number of ports. They've committed about 7 billion for public sector investment to support industrial opportunities in ports, and a number of projects have already commenced in Saldanha Bay, where Saldanha has been designated as an oil and gas hub. With respect to ports in Richards Bay, Durban, East London, Port Elizabeth, Cape Town, TNPA has already appointed transitional advisors for refurbishment and maintenance. We've already alluded to this point, where DTI has designated working vessels for local procurement. The instruction note was issued last year, August, with just 60% local content. And I think what we need to mention, what has been heartwarming for us is the fact that there was a 1.1 billion tender that was issued by TNPA for procurement of tugboats. It was awarded to a local company, and a number of industries within the value chain have also been beneficiaries of that. And while we're being informed by this company, the first tugboat will be launched in November. And as I've mentioned, that we are also in the process as a department of developing a value proposition for investors. We want to market the opportunities that are present within the blue ocean economy. The Department of Transport has also released a maritime transport policy, which includes work on cabotage on coastal, regional, and continental waters. With respect to cabotage, they are looking at a law or policy that will somehow protect our domestic shipping lines, which we do not have, or encourage shipping lines to register into our own national registry. For example, in the States, there is an act that only makes provision for only U.S. constructed ships to carry goods and services between ports in the U.S., goods and services that are coming from the States, and those they need to be registered in the U.S. And this is a way to try and increase the activities within the maritime space. And it also makes provision for them. It instructs actually for those ships to be manned by U.S. crews. So it's also a way of trying to increase employment within this space. With respect to offshore oil and gas exploration, this is a key area that is led by the Department of Energy and Minerals Resources. The DTI is just involved in the space of developing a local content roadmap. The orange button there is to just indicate where we are leading this work. And just to provide a brief feedback on it, there has been a local content work that has been done on the development of the local content roadmap, where the financial analysis of SA offshore oil and gas sector procurement was completed ahead of schedule. This work it included the determination of products and services, categories and spend values, compilation of suppliers that have placed, and classification of procurement in terms of domestic vis-a-vis foreign value addition in final goods and services. There is work that you are also doing, looking at setting minimum targets for local production and supply. However, this work awaits the finalization of the Mineral, Petrol and Resources Development Amendment Bill legislative process. Another stream that the DTI is involved in is the aquaculture through the Aquaculture Development Fund. These are some of the initiatives that have been identified under aquaculture, and feedback will just be limited to our involvement. Since the advent of Operation Pakisa, out of the 24 projects that have been identified, 10 are in progress and have secured funding from the Aquaculture Development Fund. Investment that has been leveraged to date is 305 million from the private sector, and from government is 105 million. These are expected to create over 2,000 jobs. One of our institutions, which is the National Regulator for Compulsory Specifications, has been co-opted for sampling and food safety standards. And there are EIAs that have been obtained for Hamburg, for cod and oysters. And Public Works has signed off about four leases for about four projects within this space. And maybe just to conclude, Operation Pakisa is in line with the National Development Plan and is looking to create, to promote economic growth and boost economic job creation. Marine Pakisa has concluded that the oceans have the potential to contribute about 177 billion rand to the GDP, and there is potential to create jobs over 1 million by 2033. And as a country, we are strategically positioned to serve the East and West cargo traffic lane there, because there are about 30,000 ships that pass through our shores. And rather than docking here, they would go to your Singapore. We'd want to capture that. As I've indicated, despite the fact that we do have a competitive advantage as a country, especially within the ship repair space and the refurbishment, we only capture about 1% of global market share, and we are looking at capturing about 5% going forward. And lastly, every effort is being made to ensure that Operation Pakistan initiatives are prioritized and resourced accordingly. There are interministerial committee meetings that take place on a monthly basis to monitor progress with the implementation of the three-fit plans. That's the end of my presentation, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Members who can interact. Honourable Member McPherson and Honourable Member Lewis Mkombi and Matthias and Koronov in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. Goodness. Sorry, my computer just went off. You know, Operation Pakistan has the best intentions in the world, but it has the least will in the world. And if one goes to the Operation Pakistan website and you look at the last report date, which was the 10th of July 2015, so just over 5 weeks ago, you then go into marine manufacturing. And you go into marine manufacturing, it says the following. Number of focus area activities, 71. Percentage of focus area activities completed today, 4%. Create supportive funding and revenue models. Number of activities, 6. Percentage, 0. Prioritize Transnet funding allocation towards marine manufacturing. Number of activities, 7. Percentage, 0. And the list just goes on and on about how little is actually being achieved with Operation Pakistan specifically towards the manufacturing, the marine manufacturing sector. And I find it quite shocking that up to date, it is, you know, you couldn't get these concessions from Transnet and so forth, and it took a big stick from the President's office for them to actually do so. And that goes back to my original statement that it has the best intentions, but very little will to do so. So, EG, with the greatest amount of respect, I just, the numbers according to Operation Pakistan's own website, it's just, they're not there. There's very little movement in the marine manufacturing sector. It's right there. I mean, turn your face up at me, but I mean that's the reality of what it says there. And so, I mean, I just remain unconvinced that we're going to see, you know, the jobs that have been spoken about, the investment that we've been told about, because the government itself would disagree with what's been said today. Thank you.
Chair, I just want to really underscore that point. I really want to believe that Operation Pakistan is going to make a difference and is really going to speed things up. Really, with everything inside of me, I want to believe that that's going to happen. But unfortunately, I don't see it being anything more than every other operation and action plan and turnaround strategy that government has ever had in the last however many years that has ended up being replaced by another turnaround strategy at some point in the future. And I want to just use one example that you've used in your presentation today. You have mentioned the manganese terminal at Kruger and Port Elizabeth as a example of progress. But even as you put that on the screen there today, Transnet announced just, I think it was on Thursday or Friday, that they are delaying the manganese terminal upgrade until 2021. And that the new vehicle terminal at Port Elizabeth would be delayed until 2021 as well. So I don't understand, it doesn't accord with what the things that are being claimed as successes under Pakistan, but when you look at what's actually happening, Transnet is saying, no, we're pushing this out 6 years. So So, you know, where's the Pakisa? Where's the big past results there? Where's the Kaleza there? I just don't see it translating into any actual difference. It's just more of the same.
Thanks. I'm sitting behind Honorable Korenhoff. Wants to speak before me. Well, thanks, Honorable Chair. Look, I'm also sitting with the same dilemma as other honorable members here. My first take would be that the concept of Operation Pakisa is terribly under-theorized. There's very little that one can touch that can give the essence of what this project or this initiative seeks to achieve. It seems to be all over. Despite that, it makes reference to a Malaysian model of how to fast-track service delivery on specific industries with a coordinated effort. When you look at the president's input on the introduction when on the website, it says initially this project will be led by the Department of Environmental Affairs. But now, it would seem, Operation Pakisa is situated in Department of Trade and Industry, where the coordination, where the synergy, the alignment between various departments, and at what point the Department of Environmental Affairs was involved and left off or handed over to DTR, and what are the contributions of other different strategic departments. In the last presentation, but it was not about Operation Pakisa, it was about on the web of DTR, we mentioned the importance of scrap metal around catalytic converters. It may not be relevant to the concept of Operation Pakisa, but it is a strategic economic output if it were to be looked at, and effort financially and human resources as well as intellectual can be put into that and explore the output of the catalytic converters for job creation as well as beneficiation, local beneficiation in the utilization of catalytic converters. We would have hoped that it would also be integrated into Operation Pakisa as one area to maximize and optimize our economic output. I don't know whatever the team has ever thought about that, or the ministry has ever thought about the exploitation of the catalytic converters to be an input towards the realization of economic growth and job creation. Thanks, Chair.
Chairman, sometimes it's difficult, you know, when you announce something exciting like Operation Pakisa, people don't believe you. You know, I remember when I was the MEC for Health, we never announced that we're going to embark on a mother-to-child transmission program. We only announced the results a year later. But then people will tell you, you don't tell them the truth, and you don't know what you're going to do, and you don't plan, and whatever. But I think it is good news. I think the challenge is for those two members who are negative to go to Saldanha. They haven't been to Saldanha. You've been there. And they can see the changes, what's happening in Saldanha. Kuga is a concern, but Kuga's concern is the administration of Kuga, and we all know that. But Saldanha is a good news story, and I would like to invite them just to go north in their own province to see what's happening in Saldanha. So I think the challenge for the department is going to be to watch this space closely. And really, you've announced it, but make sure that we see the necessary changes, that you sit down with Transnet, that you have your own goals and report to internally or to us, you know, the progress being made, because that will make or break Operation Bakiza. But that it's going to work, there's no doubt in my mind that there is a huge opportunity in this operation.
Honorable Mkomi.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. The success, I want to go straight to Honorable Kornos. The health success in the Western Cape began with you in your government when you launched the first health intervention in the Republic of South Africa. And there is good results today. That is why you find that the Western Cape, in terms of HIV and AIDS, is leading, is because of the ANC government. No, no, because those guys, before they went out, they announced that. Yes, they announced that Kornos has health. Yeah, because of the ANC. So this is because of the ANC. You know, they said that will never succeed. When the Western Cape government decided to intervene radically on health issues, they said that program is not going to succeed. It's all over the place, you know. But today is brewing positive results. We are sure this is going to do. But let me ask a very objective question. Through this, especially the question of the rail, transport, and manufacturing, I was just imagining, I asked the question last week, but it was not to a right person. But I think, do you see any potential in the garden route for this ocean economy issue? Because my thinking was around the question of a special economic zone, whether we can tap out in that. Is there any potential there? And who are the strategic stakeholders in this project? I'm very concerned because I was trying to explain why the difficulty of unemployment in South Africa, especially youth unemployment, is because of we are sometimes unable to coordinate concretely with the stakeholders when we do projects, especially the higher education and training. Of a department. Because I'm saying the skills revolution or the question of innovation and skills is a target, it's a moving, dynamic moving target. And what we do when we think of a project, it is mismatched with curriculum development in our country. When we meet people with those skills, they're not there, we need to train them now for this project. So what is happening? Is there any target to discuss this matter with the higher education and curriculum planners? I'm raising this because we need experts that will deal with this issue of marine transport and management. Do we have in South Africa? And if we don't have, are we checking on graduates, young graduates, that they have diplomas and degrees within this? I know there are many of them. Some of them now are running for us. And they were with me at university. So do we have that full? Now, the Saldanha one, the Saldanha Ray is going to Port Nolos away, because Port Nolos is not in Cape. It's going that straight. You said there's a rail that will move from Saldanha to Northern Cape. Or not from Saldanha too. Okay, no, thank you very much. Yeah, those were the two questions that I had.
Thank you. Over to you, DG.
Thanks again.
again, as usual, Zukiswa was with me to take the difficult one. I think, again, as I said, I think obviously with any new program, there's skepticism. And I think that's natural. But the good thing about this PAKISA program is it brings the skeptics into the same room with government and the private sector and so on. As I said, we had, for example, when we debated the issue about can we build ships and big boats and tugs in this country, there were people who swore that the NAL is absolutely useless, it's lost its capabilities, we cannot do it. They had already issued the tender and they were already procuring the research vessel from Finland. And so on. Now, again, if you looked at, as Sukiswa now said, the first tugboats, they've already started manufacturing. They will be rolled off the line in November. And even black industrialists involved in that industry now. So I'm just saying this country has immense capabilities. Now, again, you mentioned, Mkongi raised the question of the unemployment challenge. You see, we always ask, why did South Korea overtake South Africa? Why do they have no unemployment and the same population as us, whereas in the 1960s, South Africa was ahead of South Korea? One is, what is the biggest industry in South Korea? It's shipbuilding. DTI is saying we must develop our advanced manufacturing sector. We can build ships, locomotives, aircraft we can build in this country. We have the capabilities here. We have the talent. We have the companies. Just give them the procurement opportunities and give them the incentives. So what have we now done? If you saw the NAL results, they've got an order book of 35 billion rand. The biggest in its history, double the biggest in its history. But the important thing also is about the time for decisions to be made. I mentioned last week, in the automotive industry, if Mercedes-Benz wants to build the next C-Class Mercedes-Benz, they have to make that decision and get a commitment from government 7 years in advance. So we must tell them what is the incentive package 7 years. So I'm not surprised that you must understand if you agree on having a C-Class Mercedes-Benz both in South Africa and East London, don't expect it to happen tomorrow. Don't decide you're going to have a steel plant and expect to have it, you must have it in 5-6 years' time. Actually, don't make the mistake as we had, build Medupi 5 years before you need it. That's why you must make these decisions early. So what I was saying about the success of PAKISA, only in the areas that we were personally involved in breaking those log jams. We unlocked the log jam to revive our shipbuilding industry. Forever now, every vessel bought by TNPA, by defense, by our Navy, will be built in South Africa. And then the private sector also came to the party and said, they will also, we've already got a massive yacht building and boat building industry. So I'm saying that decision was unlocked. It was implemented in August. PAKISA was held in July. In August, Treasury issued the instruction notes. As I said, this November, the first tugs are rolling off the line. Now, if that is not PAKISA, I don't know what is. Secondly, as I said, a big decision, and it has been deadlocked for years, if not decades, is the building of the manganese line from the Northern Cape to Kucha, or does it come to Saldanha? The previous government decided it must be Saldanha. Even though it was a labor scarce area, we've always been fighting for everybody, and we've had, even in the DTI, we've had mediation sessions between Western Cape government, TNPA, trying to resolve the Saldanha IDZ logjam. As I said, we unlocked it in July last year. In December, TNPA made the executive decision to make the 7 billion rand investment. It is now underway. It is implemented. It is not for debate. Secondly, as I said, a long thing. Kucha is now almost 10, 15 years old. They don't have a license to operate
the manganese terminal. Because as you know, what is done there is manganese at Port Elizabeth Port. They need to ship that to the Kuha. And that has been in a log jam for 10, 15 years. All I say is that it was decided that Operation Pakisa, we had the Prime Molefe there when it was still Transnet. We debated this matter at length, even though in the short term for their balance sheet, it would have been better to transport the manganese from under the existing line, to use the existing line and so on. But all I'm saying is, so the license has now been issued, and it was issued by the Minister of Transport under the legislation, and it was approved by Cabinet 2 weeks ago. Now that they've got the license, now all those other decision-making processes can kick in and so on. So I think you can, as I said, we will show again in the public, but as I said, you must make this decision. And to give you a last example, is that we had the same issue with Aspen. Everybody, I think the portfolio committee went to Aspen Farm again. It's now the fourth largest pharmaceutical company in the world. It's a post-94 company. They were built on two things. When we introduced the first tax incentive, which is now called the 12i, again, there was a resistance to a tax incentive for companies. One of the first companies to see that tax incentive was Aspen. The second thing Aspen got is, as you know, there was a big debate about ARVs. We then insisted that 70% must go to local companies. And Aspen was one of the companies who won the ARV tenders before we even had designation. Now, as I said, 10 years later, where do we sit? We sit with world-class capabilities in the pharmaceutical industry. So as I said, people can be skeptical, but I'm saying that if we're going to get 5% growth, there's two industries which is key to it. The one is your advanced manufacturing, which is things like shipbuilding. The second one is oil and gas. That is a massive growth potential for us to get to the 5% growth. And I think Pakisa is at least, I don't know about the other 1,000-foot, there's hundreds of plants under Pakisa. I'm saying what the DTI is responsible for, those two are game changers. And as I said, we will rigorously pursue these two industries, but they do have massive potential to get us on a higher growth trajectory. But again, it won't be immediate. You will see it over time. But as I said, just like the NAL took many years to turn around, it is now a highly profitable company, the NAL. But as I said, you have to execute it. And the same with Malaysian Airlines. I mean, I think, as you said, it's to make the critical decisions at the right time.
I think we need to clarify the role of the DTI within the Operation Pakisa. Operation Pakisa is an initiative that is led by the presidency, but the Department of Trade and Industry is an implementing agency for the marine manufacturing. We have a number of departments being implementing agencies. The Department of Transport is responsible for some of the initiatives. The Department of Higher Education is responsible for the skills initiatives. The Department of Public Enterprises is responsible for the infrastructure initiatives. What you are here to present, we are presenting our own initiatives as the Department of Trade and Industry, which is our own contribution to the big initiative, which is Operation Pakisa. The Department of Monitoring and Evaluation within the presidency is responsible for coordinating all the initiatives within the four streams that have been identified within the marine Pakisa. I just wanted to clarify that point. He also raised the issue of Catholic converters. I think this one was only limited to the maritime, the blue oceans, any matter that has to do with the blue oceans. And the catalytic converters would be part of the coming Pakisa, which is the mining Pakisa, because it's part of the offset of the platinum platinum mining, and members must watch the space because it is expected to take place in October. This will be covered there in more detail, and there will be initiatives that will come out of that. I think we welcome the positive comment and the encouraging words from the honourable member. We will watch the space. With respect to
No, I think we haven't. The two areas that could potentially come up is obviously Mossel Bay, which I think is definitely in terms of the ocean economy proper. But two areas that have started coming up a lot is actually Port Nolloth and Mossel Bay as other growth nodes. And so, as I said, we didn't cover it at the time of Operation Vakisa, but I know now they've just also discovered they've just opened a zinc mine in the Northern Cape, and I think they're looking at Port Nolloth, and that area has apparently potential, but so has, I think, then there's Mossel. I think, let me also conclude, I think, yes, on the question of the platinum, it's a very important point. I think you won't be disappointed, but one of the key things at this new operation, Pakistan for the mining, they'll be dealing with two things. They'll be dealing with the mining sector as it is now with all its challenges, but it will also be dealing with the beneficiation. And one of the key products is the platinum. And there's two sectors that we are putting forward for growth potential in terms of platinum. The one is the catalytic converter industry, which we already 10% of world production we have. And there's potential to take that to become, for us to become a world player in catalytic converters, but then also for fuel cells for energy generation. As we know, there's a current project in Kroonstad. We launched one at the Chamber of Mines where we're showing that you can, for off-grid power, can come from fuel cell technology. So hopefully we will get the buy-in of all the role players then into using platinum for upstream beneficiation. But similarly, with a similar process, we will now have in the room, we will have the producers of platinum. We will have the beneficiating, the catalytic converter companies will be there. We'll have Ballard, the people who make the fuel cells. We'll have Angloplats, and so on. So you'll have them all in the room, so hopefully they will be able to come up with a 10-foot plan on how do we revive or how do we grow the platinum beneficiation.
Thank you, DJ. I'm sorry, we have run out of our time. Honorable Mkomi, special request. You know the ruling by the chair. If you want any other further issue to raise, yes, Mr. Hemen, you communicate with the department. DJ, thank you very much for your presentation. The meeting is adjourned, members. Thank you.